Pulp Arcana, the Vintage Pulp Paperback Morgue.
This segment of Pulp Arcanum will focus on the price market of horror paperbacks for the spring of 2021. There's been an expansive increase in collectors of vintage horror paperbacks over recent years. Thus, the pursuit of finding your most desirable cover makes it all more challenging. Firstly, on May 17th, 2021, eBay, Johnstone's always been a hot collector. Baby Grand once was selling for $25 back in the winter, now going for $40, $50 this spring, 2021. This is a great cover with skeleton playing the piano. Keeping with Zebra and William W. Johnstone again from his Cats series, Cat's Eye, with the toddler being nursed by his mother in his arms. So that went in a bidding war. $20 plus $2.89 for shipping in April 2021. Now this is an old and early Zebra printing here. Dementia Vintage 70 Sleaze Horror Fiction. Keith Parnell went for $18 USD back in late April. I've always wanted this one, but I haven't had it yet. Hope to come across it. That's a decent price. Still under $20 for that one, for one that's about to be 50 years old. Now, another great seller, Ruby Jean Jensen. Now, this one went pretty high. Cover looks pretty glossy and good overall. This is from 91, so 30-year-old book this year. Usually see it going under $20 or around the $20 range. Usually hers are pretty collectible. This went for $58, including shipping on that. That's pretty high, especially since some of her other ones are going for under $20 since there's been recent reprints of her work. Another Ruby Jean Jensen that sold May 15th. This is Annabelle. Nothing to do with the famous Conjuring spinoff series. $20, $24 overall, about $25. So that's a decent price for the buyer there. This is a great cover. Look at that. The doll with the noose on it. I once got this in a novelization lot where someone thought this was the Annabelle series and they threw it in there with like 30 Days a Night and Starship Troopers and stuff, other ones. So it was a good deal for me. I got it for like $30 with those other ones. So $25 for that. Great. Now, then Best Friends from Ruby Jean Jensen. This one from her went pretty cheap. It's pretty beat up spine here, but around $9, around $10 after tax for Best Friends. That's the one with the kid who looks frightened, who's gripping the purple cat, who's like half his face is a skull. He's got a laser left eye. And then more recently, Toy Cemetery by William W. Johnstone. This is the one where the little toy doll is propped up against the tombstone. This one went for $20 and it benefited charity. That concludes episode one of the horror paperback market. We'll continue on with sellings in the spring of 2021 in the next episode. This was JBM from Pulp Arcanum. One of the hottest selling horror paperbacks in the summer of 2021 happens to be a Bantam book from 1983, a nonfiction. It's valuable, it's coveted, it's rare. Let's go into the reasons why. Recently, I've been gathering and categorizing a lot of my occult and hauntings, strange happenings, all my nonfiction type of paranormal and supernaturals. The Edgar Cayces, the Hans Holzers, the pseudosciences, all into this nice little bookshelf. That led to my research on some recent sales of what's been going on. To my astonishment, I found some exorbitant sales in the nonfiction category. We're talking Curtis Richards level sales. In early July 2021, the only listing, active listing, on eBay for The Devil in Connecticut was for $1,500. And tracking back a few months, there had been nearly a dozen sales of the book, ranging from $100 to a few hundred dollars. Now, the cover for The Devil in Connecticut is unremarkable and bland. It's one of those staged photos where it's a white suburban home, doorway ajar, emitting a glowing mist. So it didn't really stand out to me. But it evoked a spark of a memory for it. I said, I think I might have that book. At my house, I have thousands of books, but I'm still not able to store and archive every book in my collection, so I have them in deep storage at different places. So I poured over all my books at home. I know I didn't have it. I had it in deep storage because I pick up every book with a ghost or a devil on it everywhere I go. And this cover didn't really stand out to me, and so I just put it away. And I remember, so I come across it every now and then, but again, I don't look at it too much, so I didn't know too much about the book. So on the 4th of July, I'm searching all my storage bins endlessly for The Devil in Connecticut, the bland red spine of Devil in Connecticut, thinking that years ago I bought it and I have it, hoping I have it. Then, as I'm about to give up on it, nestled in between The Possession of Joel Delaney and Prophets in Hell, it emerged in all its paperback from hell glory. The Devil in Connecticut was released in November 1983 by Bantam Books with a retail price of $3.50. It just so happens to be based on the case files that serves as the inspiration for The Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It, released in June 2021. Authored by Gerald Brittle, who had previously collaborated with Ed and Lorraine Warren on their first book, The Demonologist, released in 1980. Upon examining the back cover, what initially hooked me onto the book was a little blurb by Ed and Lorraine Warren themselves, which reads, "Our most shocking case since the Amityville Horror." Similar to the Amityville Horror, this one takes the dual case of devil possession and real-life murder. From the prologue, Gerald Brittle clearly states that this data is taken from the victims, the Warrens themselves, who served as the chief investigators of this theory, photos and audio tapes of the phenomena during this investigation. For context, it's important to note that Ed and Lorraine Warren were prominently involved in the Amityville Horror case and were even featured in the original 1977 Jay Anson book because they were investigators of the house. But the movie deals never came, and the Amityville franchise became its own beast, both in fiction and in film. Moving on, in the early 80s, the Warrens continued their exploration into the occult. Now, I have no intention of spoiling the story here, but just plan on giving a overview of the devil in Connecticut itself. The Glatzel family of Connecticut had been experiencing demonic possession, including their young sons. What makes this case particularly stand out is the hierarchical devil possession here, known as the Beast, is this entity that haunts them, later revealed to be a high-ranking demon. Now, months after attempting to spiritually cleanse this family of the demons, tragedy had struck Brookfield, Connecticut in a murderous way. Arne Johnson, a friend of the family who had previously provoked the malicious demon, was now charged with the stabbing, brutal murder. Needless to say, the Warrens came rushing back into the town after the case hit the national spotlight, and using their case files, vehemently come into the defense of a murderer claiming demonic possession, claiming he was actually the victim. Regardless of that validity, I find the similitudes to Amityville Horror to be striking. Firstly, the title, The Devil in Connecticut, a locational title, similar to The Amityville Horror. The marketing of a true story and demonic possession, just like in The Amityville Horror. A murderer who claims devilish possession, like Ronald DeFeo. It's almost like a reverse Amityville Horror in its storyline. And lastly, the prosaic prose has all the dryness similar to Jay Anson's Amityville Horror in all its straightforwardness. The police and prosecutors ignored the defense of the Warrens and their claims of demonic possession of murderer Arne Johnson. The book was released a few years later after the murder conviction, with heavy controversy involving real-life victims and true events. These and other factors supposedly led to the book itself's suppression of sales and distribution. Decades later, the Warrens and their case files have been revived for film renditions in the Conjuring franchise, one of the more successful horror franchises of the 2010s. The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, is based directly on the case file notes of The Devil in Connecticut, years after out-of-print obfuscation. The book was finally re-released in concurrence with the film's release in June 2021 by Gray Malkin Media. Despite this newfound access, the original 1983 Bantam Books release remains a hot seller this summer on eBay. I have no critical theories in regards to the events presented by the Warrens in the book, but it is compelling in many facets and its layers. This concludes the story on all that is buzzing about the paperback, The Devil in Connecticut, a nonfiction horror from Bantam Books. This has been a Pulp Arcanum segment by JBM from the Pulp Arcanum podcast. Search your apps to listen to full episodes. Founded in 1957, for decades, Leisure Books distributed an array of popular fiction. It garnered success catering to the flavors of the market through the years. from sci-fi and westerns in the early years and turning to darker content like thrillers and horror by the mid-80s. Published March 1st, 1986, Resurrexit by Leona C. Ross. This falls into the subgenre of horror, supernatural, medical, occult. Possessed by twisted passion, she risked damnation to raise her lover from the dead. The etymology is a little complex, but essentially it means to rise again under the derivatives of resurgence or resurrection from the Latin roots. A similar cover, also published by Leisure 2 years later in 1988, is John Teague's Vessel, also featuring a hand gripping a chalice featuring a bloody liquid. Now, I'm in preference more towards Resurrexit. We have more ornate chalice here, like these type of aquatic monstrous creatures. Even a better base. You got the blood pouring out over here. Even the hand looks more scary. Now, an examination. This one has a reflection in it where Resurrexit doesn't. It's the fingernail polish. I mean, if it didn't have the red fingernail polish, maybe it'd be more grim. John Teague's had a number of horror novels published by Leisure, all with tremendous covers. On to the review of Resurrexit 1986 by Leona C. Ross. A young couple rent a shabby cabin in Maine for the summer. Although they're on a break from college in New York, Mike and Sandy do newlywed things like talk about having a baby and renovate the cabin with fun home improvement projects. In the attic, they discover an Ouija board and meet a spirit named Simon that compels them to visit his gravestone in the cemetery down the road. When they visit the town's library to research Simon's grave, that's when we meet the book's antagonist, Fanny, a psychopathic crone who spent her life concocting the perfect resurrection elixir. Fanny is awestruck at how closely Mike resembles her dead lover, Simon. He's the anatomical quintessence of what host she needs to perform this revival. Not revealing her intentions, she soon woos Sandy into the temptation of communicating with ghosts by using magnets on the Ouija board to spell out subtle directives. An abundance of guile, coffee, and cigarettes occupy the pages. Mike is fed up with their antics, but before he leaves her behind, Sandy lures him into a deadly sacrament. Dressed in robes, a huddled cult encroaches on Mike, forcing him to guzzle down the red liquid, Simon's blood, and the ornate chalice seen gracing the cover. He wakes up the next morning, unharmed, and begins a slow transmogrification into Simon. Delusions and the horrid memories of Simon's tragic death materialize in Mike's mind. It turns out Fanny's treachery runs deep and vile. Simon was indeed her former lover back in the 1920s. However, she's also his murderer after catching him cheating with her sister. Fearing Simon may like the youthful Sandy, Fanny's haunting jealousy drives her to lock Sandy in a room and let her voracious boa constrictor devour her. Fanny had manipulated Sandy into believing it was ghosts and devilry, not letting her know about her youth serum. She had paid the nearby gravedigger to don a robe and be the muscle, but even he was swindled on payment. This is halfway through the book, and it feels like the climax. Fanny's farmhouse burns down, killing the gravedigger. Sandy escapes and ends up assigned to an asylum with amnesia and catatonia. A year rolls by, and Sandy is finally released into the care of no one. Among a slew of other nonsense, the book's logic starts to crumble, becoming extremely disjointed. Where were her parents? Why weren't Mike's notified? She wanders back to the cabin they had rented last summer. Somehow she's allowed to live there with no income. Simon, seeking revenge on Fanny, pops into Sandy's life, believing she'll eventually be able to lead him to Fanny. He's charming at first. That's until he gets her pregnant. Cold and now distant, he starts aging rapidly with chunks of flesh decaying. He must find Fanny before he rots. However, Fanny is hiding out in underground tunnels, waiting for her youth pills to kick in. She can't very well re-enter Simon's life looking like a hag. This woman's insanity has no limitations. Sandy copes with all this by smoking while pregnant. After refusing to give him the youth pills, Simon goes bonkers and buries Fanny alive in his old grave, then ties Sandy to the tombstone. He succumbs to physical decay and dies. Is this the climax? No, Franny survives by eating anyone who treads over the cemetery grounds. Her underground tunnels lead back to her barn on the Willoughby farm. Sandy forsakes the place and reunites with her parents in New York, unwillingly to divulge anything that actually happened. Her memory finally returns, knowing now everyone's motives and how she was deceived. Eventually, the cops summon her back to Maine after bodies start piling up. But guess what? It's time to deliver Simon's abominable baby. Fanny figures using Simon's blood on his own son will splice the DNA better this time around. Disguised as a nurse, she whisks the baby away and injects it with the serum. However, it isn't Simon's baby. It's Mike's baby, if that makes any sense. Something about soul transference, even though the supernatural element had been debunked by Fanny throughout the book. Whatever. In the end, Sandy and Mike reconcile, and of course, the hospital burns down, seemingly killing Fanny. My final thoughts are, despite the narration's uneven path, Leona C. Ross has beautiful prose that makes it worth giving a read. If it wasn't another author's pseudonym, it was her only book published. The only other Leona Ross I found on the web was a woman who started a GoFundMe in 2017, imploring for donations to pay her heat and electric bills in order for her fur babies to survive. This was another segment from the Pulp Arcanum podcast. Review by JBM, published. The story behind the abrupt suicide of Robert E. Howard is a poignant and sorrowful tale. At 30, a vernal age for writers, he left behind a surprisingly large trove of impactful work. Between Solomon Kane and Conan the Barbarian, Howard forged a fantasy genre later defined as sword and sorcery, making him an icon of popular fiction of 20th century literature. June 11th, 1936 was his fatal day, and now the day is celebrated among Robert E. Howard fan circles as a day of celebration of the wonderful man's work. Now I'm going to share a reading written by Robert E. Howard's father, who is a doctor himself, to the wonderful H.P. Lovecraft later that month, detailing the death of his great friend. Dated June 29th, 1936. Mr. H.P. Lovecraft, 666 College Street, Providence, Rhode Island. Actually, it's 66 College Street, if there'd be some really deeper occultic ties with H.P. Lovecraft if he lived on 666 in Providence, Rhode Island. So, my dear Mr. Lovecraft, it is barely possible through some other source that you may have heard of the death of Robert E. Howard, my son. If not, I will say that after 3 weeks of vigilant watching at his mother's bedside, on the morning of June 11, 1936, at 8 o'clock, he slipped out of the house, entered his car, which was standing in front of the garage, raised the windows, and fired a shot through his brain. The cook standing at the window at the back part of the house saw him get in his car. She thought he was fixing to drive to town as he usually did. When she heard the muffled sound
of the gun, she saw him fall over the steering wheel. She ran in the house and called the physician, who was in the house. The doctor was taking a cup of coffee in the dining room, and I was talking with him. We rushed to the car and found him. We thought at first that it was a death shot by the bullet, but the bullet has passed through his brain. He shot himself just above the temple. It came out on the opposite side, just above and behind the left ear. He lived 8 hours and never regained consciousness. I was watching Robert as this was premeditated, and I knew it, but I did not think that he would kill himself before his mother went. His mother was in a coma and had been for many hours when this occurred. There were two trained nurses in the house and doctors there all the time. He did not ask a doctor, neither did he ask me, but he asked a nurse if she thought his mother would ever regain consciousness enough to know him, and the nurse told him she feared not. This was known to me. This was unknown to me, actually. Had I known, I might have prevented this, because I know now that he fully had made up his mind not to see his mother die. Last March, a year ago, again when his mother was very low in the King's Daughters Hospital in Temple, Texas, Dr. McClevey expressed a fear that she would not recover. He began to talk to me about his business, and I at once understood what it meant. I began to talk to him, trying to dissuade him from such a course, but his mother began to improve. Immediately she began to improve. He became cheerful, and no more was sad. Actually, no more was said about it. Again this year, in February, while his mother was very sick and not expected to live but a few days, at the time, she was in the Shannon Hospital in San Angelo, Texas. San Angelo is something like 100 miles from here. He was driving back and forth daily from San Angelo to home. One evening, he told me I would find his business. What little there was to it, all carefully written up and in a large envelope. In his desk. Again, I begged him not to do it, but he positively did not intend to live after his mother was gone. As the months grew on, his mother showed some improvement. He accepted her condition as one permanent improvement and one that would continue. I knew well that it would not, but I kept it from him rapidly. 2 weeks before she died, she began to decline rapidly. I saw the awful worry that came over him. I was following him and watching him closely, but did not think he would do anything until his mother was gone. In that, I was mistaken, because he never intended to see his mother die. The night before his death, he assumed an almost cheerful attitude, seemed very much interested about me, as if he intended to take the lead and take care of me. He came to me in the night and put his arm around me and said, "Buck up. You're equal to it. You will go through it all right." He completely disarmed me of the intention of his death. But I knew well what to expect afterwards. He died without ever showing the least return of consciousness at 4 o'clock, June 11th, 1936. His mother lingered 31 hours, never regaining consciousness. I buried them both in the Greenleaf Cemetery at Brownwood, Texas. I selected caskets exactly alike. He had purchased a burial lot a week before this happened. It was in the restricted portion of the cemetery. The purchase carried with it a perpetual upkeep. When he bought the lot, he went to the sexton and wanted to know if it was a bona fide contract and if it would be taken care of. He said to the sexton, "I want to know if the lot will be kept in order. My father and I will go away and never come again." Mr. Bass, the sexton, was under the impression that he contemplated something in which he would go all in, all go, but he did not expect to kill me, but knew the shock would kill me. He was careful to keep nurses and doctors around me, but no doubt thought I would die from shock, and which I think the last few lines he ever typed would indicate. These lines were found on a strip of paper in his billfold. in his hip pocket after he shot himself. The lions follow. All fled, all done, so lift me on the pyre. The feast is over, and the lamps expire. I do not know whether these words were a quotation or original, but they were typed, no doubt, shortly before his death. I do not know what was in his mind. I have tried to interpret this as being the last of all the family. The feast, the 30 years of love of the family life in our home. Robert loved me with a love that was beautiful. He loved my companionship above that of anyone else, and every time opportunity afforded, he spent his time with me in preference to anyone else. But being a country doctor and practicing medicine in a country comparatively thinly settled, I was away from home most of the time. But when I was permitted to be at home, our hours were spent pleasantly on discussion of men, women, animals, outdoor life, adventure, history of long-lived frontiersmen, and such like. He was a great reader. It made me so happy to sit and listen. He acquired a knowledge by reading of history that I never knew. Lest I worry you with this, I will close, but will say in conclusion, Mr. Lovecraft, that Robert was a great admirer of you. I have often heard him say that you were the best weird writer in the world, and he keenly enjoyed corresponding with you, often expressed hope that you might visit in our home someday so that he, his mother, and I might see and know you personally. Robert greatly admired all weird writers, often heard him speak of each separately and express the highest admiration of all. He said that they were a bunch of great men, and he admired all of them very much. The Howard Page College of Brownwood has asked for letters of correspondence. If it is agreeable with you, I will furnish them with some of your correspondence to him, as he has some in his files, and they are interested in letters. His books were given to the Howard Payne College, and we will be known as the Robert E. Howard Memorial Collection. It is so arranged that it is possible to add it as friends see fit. If you have a book that you would like to add to it with an autograph, it will be greatly appreciated. Yours truly, Dr. I. M. Howard. I am mailing you a bundle of papers that contains the full of it all. This and other letters pertaining to Robert E. Howard can be found in the Howard Collector, published by Ace in 1979 and edited by Glenn Lord. Now, like you, reading this letter in context, I just found it so sorrowful. It affirms that Robert E. Howard had a vast and enviable knowledge of history to have created such a memorable genre of sword and sorcery. It really would have been impossible for him to have constructed it without the influence of history. And the premeditation behind the suicide is what might be most unsettling and startling from this. You'd hate to speculate what could have been tormenting him so badly. Each June 11th, I usually seek out a bookstore and comb the shelves for their sword and sorcery or fantasy section, seeking a Robert E. Howard reprint. The Lancer novels can still be found in some nooks and crannies at different bookstores. These were published in the late 60s. Howard's rhythmic prose has aged finely and is still a great adventure experience in fiction. This has been a Pulp Arcanum segment. Seek out my Facebook page. Having published dozens of titles since 1974, Englishman Guy N. Smith has been a formidable figure at etching the style and themes of horror fiction. It's an orthodox recipe of pulp and exploitation, however. Savagery, sensuality, and monster escapades, shotgunned at the reader with the brevity of an analeptic rush. Ah, hell, nothing further typifies his pulp horror template, none other than his Crab series, first published starting in 1976 by New English Library.
Now, outside of these books, which have always been immensely popular and continue to become more collectible, he even released the latest book of the series, The Charnel Caves, in 2019, the year that he turned 80, which was last year. But outside of crabs, however, and when it comes to Guyan Smith, the slime beast has to be his other lovable character. A monster from Earth, or from beyond the stars. The Slime Beast, first published in 1975 by New English Library. Everything about this creature oozes hideosity. It looks like the sucking pit morphed into human form and a mimicry of the creature from the Black Lagoon. The back cover synopsis reads as follows. Members of an innocent expedition in search of King John's missing treasure discover not the promised riches, but something far more insidious. For in the wilds of the East Coast marshes, they encounter an alien creature of hideous strength, the Slime Beast, and its enemy is man. In the conflict with superstitious villagers and a power-crazed professor, only two people remain determined to destroy the beast unless it kills them first. The marshy location mentioned in the plot is known as the Wash, on the east shore of England, an estuary with a deep history. On an expedition to search for King John's treasure, our party consists of three: a Professor Lawson, who's an ornery old man, an assistant museum employee named Gavin, and the niece of the professor named Liz. They start metal detecting the mud flats, only to be interrupted by a few different locals, including a bird watcher who's pissed off that they might scare away the pink-feeted geese. Being a mere 100-and-some pages, the story rapidly unfolds as Guyan Smith's prose is similar to that of a chicken nugget. They discover a slimy alloy forearm quickly, with its form that of a reptilian source. Professor Lawson quickly asserts it's otherworldly. Not even of the darkest places of the Amazon can this creature be found. Leaving it in the woods, the characters begin to take unpredictable paths. In town, there's this kind of like hotel/tavern where the local drunks start getting hostile with them. They even talk about how they saw a meteorite the night before and thought they might be searching for... They're used to people searching for the treasure and whatnot, so they're disgruntled and want them to basically leave. Of course, there's a local constable that gets involved, and some of the other guys who wanted them to leave, they have their own encounters with the beast and end up dead. There's an attempted rape on Professor's niece, Liz. Meanwhile, she's still hooking up with Gavin, the assistant museum employee. Professor Lawson starts to have megalomaniac tendencies and wanting to capture the creature and harness its power. After hearing of the meteorite being struck down, though, Gavin's theory formulates to that of some alien race sent a ship to Earth to seek out a water world because theirs is drying up, and this being a sort of slime creature and ended up in this marshland that it was seeking a good water source, and Earth being covered in mostly water would be a good host world. The slime beast rises from its torpid state to go on an aggressive attack spree. The army is unnecessarily called in, and its scales are able to ward off bullets. Crazy Professor Lawson remains mostly inactive and just plotting in the campsite and for most of the book, until his grand scheme is to come up with an unbreakable net to capture the creature. Ultimately, the trajectory of the story takes on a thin and plain plot line as we follow the creature go on its voracious rampage. A true pulp thrill ride adventure where no violence
is spared in any form, as each death is described in graphic detail from Guyon Smith. 40 years after its release, Guyon Smith wrote a sequel called Spawn of the Slime Beast. With this dreadful cover that looks photocopied from some awful scholastic book sale with an Arl Stein name slapped on it. This has been a Pulp Arcanum segment. For more, search any podcast. The Horror Paperback Market, Episode 2, R.L. Stein Book Sales, Spring 2021. Firstly, Fear Street. Now, Netflix is coming out with their trilogy of movies this summer, and the trailer just hit, so these books are definitely going to be even hotter than they've always been. Right now, you could still get a select few under $10, but one of the more popular ones that I see selling regularly for around $30, and in this occasion, $38, is Cat, with the tagline being C-A-T spells murder. Now, this is one I've kind of desired, and it's like the teenage babe dressed in a black turtleneck, looking at you menacingly with cat eyes herself, caressing and holding a cat. There's a great blog review of this. I've read ones before, that Fear Street 1 blog on Blogger. Anyway, so I've always waited for this price to be reasonable, like under $10 back in the day. I didn't even know that it jumped up to these heights recently, so cats are popular. Cats sell. So do dogs, like the Shiba Inu. R.L. Stein's Senior Series, A Fear Street Super Chiller. Graduation Day, Episode 12. Went for $42. A lot of these books from these Senior Series, you wouldn't think it. They don't look too vintage, but they go for a price. As well, in late April, this one went for over $40. From his Senior Series, Prom Date, Episode 11. And folks, if you're listening to this on the podcast, these have to be some of the weakest, vapid, dull covers of an R.L. Stein book. Alright, let's bring it back down to earth, though, in the 90s. Who Killed the Homecoming Queen? Of Fear Street. And the new queen is dead. Sold May 5th, 2021 for $24. Lastly, I'll give you an example of what I Live in Your Basement, number 61, second to last Goosebumps series. This went and sold recently for $88 online. I love how it gives the tagline of Watch Goosebumps on Fox Kids Network. This one's got this kind of blobbish monster coming out of the laundry and opening up to devour. Yeah, so it's going for close to $90. If you want to get a whole series, like obviously the last few, they didn't print as many, so weren't passed around as much. Same with the NES. The last few games out of the NES are some of the most expensive too, because they didn't distribute them as much. This has been a Pulp Arcanum segment, brought to you by no one, because no one would sponsor such a censorious pariah like myself. Pulp Arcanum is a podcast featuring content and discussions on the pulp fiction genres of 20th century literature, horror, adventure, fantasy, and sci-fi. The fantastical stories published in the 1920s pulp magazines ignited the era with an explosion of strange and weird tales. To participate in upcoming skull sessions on the podcast, email me directly at pulparcanum@gmail.com. That's PulparCanum. For Facebook, there's a page, Pulp Arcanum Podcast.
Also, many paperback collection photos are featured on the Instagram.